Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Thursday, the 23rd of August. The biographer of Gore Vidal is our guest this hour. We had a program scheduled a couple of weeks ago on Gore Vidal with this same guest. And as you know, the literary and cultural iconoclast died last month. The Sikh temple shootings preempted that program, but we wanted to reschedule this program on Gore Vidal, so this is the day and this is the hour. And our guest is Fred Kaplan. He's the author of Gore Vidal, a biography. He's also the author of Lincoln, the biography of a writer, and Fred has written biographies of Charles Dickens and Henry James. He is currently writing a biography of John Quincy Adams. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. He's joining us by phone from Maine, where he lives. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also send us messages on our Facebook page if you would like, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So we welcome Fred Kaplan. Hello, Fred.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I'm so glad we could reschedule this program. Thank you so much for being with us today. Let's go to the 1990s. You get a phone call from Gore Vidal's literary agent asking if you would be interested in writing his biography. Was it because, as you suggest, Vidal had looked at your biographies of Dickens and Henry James and he wanted to be in the same company and he liked what you wrote?
Yes, I can't guarantee that he ever read anything.
Uh-oh.
But he was a man who had a very keen ear for what was going on in the literary world and had a sense of what his own importance was. And it was, in fact, his literary executor, Jay Perini, a fine poet and novelist himself, who had recommended me to Gore.
Mm.
And I suspect that Gore glanced at some of the things I had written, but that Jay's word played a very important role.
You say that you got to know Gore Vidal quite well. Are there many people who can say that about him, or not many?
Well, you know, when I say I got to know him quite well, I suppose that needs a little bit of qualification, which is that at some level he was, at some deep level, he really was unknowable. I suppose to a great extent we all are. But Gore had a way of disguising or disappearing his inner self. He claimed, actually, that in Freudian terms, he didn't have an inner self, that what you see is what you got. But I did spend a great deal of time with him and, of course, interviewed him and other people for hundreds and hundreds of hours. And I had full access to his archives and all the material and the cooperation of all of his associates. So I did get, in that sense, to know him quite well. And I did see him in different moods at different times and in different stages of our relationship. Other people did get to know him, yes. He had relationships, of course, over the years and friends over the years. He was a man who made friends but made enemies as quickly as he made friends.
Mm. Did he let you talk?
Did he let me talk? Well, sometimes, but he was not a man given to dialogue, especially as he grew older. He was a brilliant monologuist with a great sense of his own theatrical presence, with a deep and resonant voice that he used very effectively to dominate conversations.
Yes, he did. You remember that voice. We'll hear it a little bit later on in that exchange with William Buckley. I think sometimes people got them mixed up because they both had that voice that demanded attention, right?
Exactly, exactly. Both of them estimable characters.
Yes. You talk about, and I must say that I loved his book on Lincoln. I love Lincoln, and I've been to Springfield and reread it on my last trip to Springfield. But you write that two of his historical novels, Burr and Julian, are gems, but that Lincoln ruffled Lincoln scholars. I wasn't aware of that. Why?
Gore came from a southern world via Washington, D.C., And he had a strong sense that the American culture and American society prior to the Civil War was a very strong and creative one, and that in a sense ever since the Civil War there had been a falling away. And in his own way, Gore was a small government man. I mean, not a small government man in the sense of the modern Republican Party and its emphasis upon how terrible big government is and how we all ought to embrace small government, but a small government man in the sense that he idealized the early republic. He could be harshly critical or at least de-idealizing of the great founding fathers and be quite realistic about them. But he idealized the early republic and had a sense that everything since the Civil War was a falling away. His own vision of America was of a decentralized America, and he had a strong sense that the country had simply become too big and too complicated.
What did you think of Lincoln?
What do I think of Lincoln? Let me just respond for a moment to what Gore thought of Lincoln. Gore thought of that Lincoln, in essence, had a big government tyrannical impulse. And he compared, in the final paragraphs of his novel, Lincoln, he compared Lincoln to Bismarck, the great 19th century unifier of Germany. His notion of Lincoln was that Lincoln, from the very start, had a vision of kind of using the iron fist, if necessary, to solidify and unite the country into one big empire. And empire became Gore's political bête noir in the 80s and the 90s, the notion that modern America was simply attempting to dominate the world. It had become the new empire, inherited the mantle of the British Empire, and he saw Lincoln as the start of that. I did not think that that aspect of his depiction of Lincoln was accurate, and most Lincoln scholars object to that. They enjoyed and emphasized that this was a piece of fiction, this was a novel, it was based on historical fact, but much of the interpretation of Lincoln's character and of his public policy was Gore Vidal's attempt to impose on Lincoln his own view of where America was and where it had come from.
Interesting. It is a great read, though.
Oh, I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. But you see, of course, Lincoln is so idealized and idolized, sometimes a bit too extravagantly in terms of the historical record, but still, you know, acknowledged to be our great, or if not our greatest president. As you can see why lots of readers would have been ruffled, and Lincoln scholars, who are historians who have a preference for accuracy and truth, would find the novel difficult. You and I, we loved it, but they did.
Right. How did he find his way? He was somewhat omnipresent on TV. When people needed a commentator and you knew that he would be a good one, there he was. Did he relish that, being a TV commentator?
He loved it.
He loved it. Yeah.
I think one of his maxims that sometimes quoted, I think it comes from an interview, not from anything he wrote, is that that there are two things you should never turn down. A chance to have sex and to be on television. Not simultaneously. You didn't mean that. But no, he loved television. He was a ham and loved public performance. And he got, you know, extremely good at it. He developed sort of a character persona. Everyone knew what to expect, and many of us relished it. We looked forward to every appearance of his.
Did he love sex as well? I read somewhere that he had maybe 1,000 partners, is that true?
Well, that's a comment that he made, and it may very well, you know, not be precisely accurate, but the general tenor and tone of it, I think, is accurate. Gore's sex life had the complication of his being able to respond both to women and to men. But overall, his preference was for men. And it began early on in his life with the one love affair, or the one deep love that he ever confessed to, and which I think he fictionalized to some considerable extent, with the young Jimmy Trimble when they were adolescent boys together in Washington. So Gore's taste in sex was essentially for men, and particularly for young men, adolescents, if you will. And he held on to that for most of his life. Both Gore and his longtime partner, the wonderful Howard Austin, who I admired very much, and who died some years before Gore, thought of sex as something impersonal and having little or nothing to do with love. And consequently, they preferred, in fact, to pay for sex rather than to engage in a relationship, because that's not what sex was about as far as they were concerned. So, of course, large numbers, if you will, can be racked up if that is your approach and if you have the means to fulfill it.
You talk about his essays and say that many think that his essays are his best work. Tell me about the variety of his essays and why those are cited as this is really his best work.
Gore had a great talent for the essay. And one of the reasons is the immense variety of interests that he had, which allowed him to be knowledgeable in an effective way about a variety of subjects, particularly, of course, literary and political, though some others as well. At the same time, he found precisely the right tone that expressed the particularity of the mind, of his mind, as a writer of an essay, and at the same time, gave the reader the opportunity to feel fully his appreciation for what it was that he was writing about, particularly in the literary essays, but also in the political essays. Another feature that he had was, and we've alluded to this already, he had a great talent for having an authoritative voice, without that voice being overbearing or aggressive in a way that put off readers. So he could find just the right note. In addition, he was, as a writer, immensely concise and intense at the same time. And that particularly came out in the essays, when he could write in a shorter form that allowed him to engage with reality, with history, with literature, with politics, and yet at the same time use his imaginative and intellectual capabilities to convey the essence of what it was he wanted to say about history, politics, and literature. He also was a wonderful reader, and many of his essays, not only the literary ones, though predominantly the literary ones, are readings of close but not overly close communications of the thoughts and the feelings of a very good reader, telling you about things of importance to you that you also might engage with. That's a fairly long answer, but he really is a brilliant essayist.
Fred Kaplan is our guest this hour. He is author of a number of books, but captivating us this hour is his book on Gore Vidal, Gore Vidal, A Biography. We're welcoming phone calls on Gore Vidal's life, who Fred Kaplan says deserves more than a footnote, or at least a very long footnote, in discussions of the American scene and American culture between 1960 and 1990. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. He was, as Fred said, loved to be on television, and many of us remember his appearances. He also is the author of a number of historical novels, which I know many of you have read and would like to critique this hour, and of course, a number of essays as well. So let's look at the body of his work and Gore Vidal, the man, this hour of the show with you as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the next hour of our program, a former GOP strategist who's written quite a book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Let's go to phone calls. We have many of them for Fred Kaplan. His book is Gore Vidal, a biography. He has written other books on Lincoln, the biography of a writer, and other biographies as well. I believe he's working on one now on John Quincy Adams. We'll ask him about that as the hour progresses. Randy in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. In addition to my questions, I'd be curious to know, Mr. Kaplan, how Jay Perini regarded his client. In my particular questions, I kept noticing so many contradictions with Gore Vidal, that he was this fairly hard left, but very blue blood type, hardly a champion of the proletariat, it seemed. His first Edgar Box mystery, and I'm assuming you read those as well, that struck me as being almost viciously anti-gay, even for its time. The late Christopher Hitchens, his friend, said that towards the end of his life, he was going to be pretty cranky, and he had sort of a Jewish problem. I was wondering if you could comment on any of those.
Yes, of course. You raise a lot of interesting questions and issues about a very complex man. First, about Jay Perini. Jay Perini is a wonderful and flexible and engaging human being. And Jay got to know Gore when Jay was in Italy for some period of time, and they got along immensely well. And Jay has this tremendous capacity for getting along immensely well with all sorts of people. I would surmise with everybody. So, but I have never been, privy to the ins and the outs of Jay and Gore's relationship. And it will be interesting one day, and I hope this will happen, if hear from Jay in an essay or in some other form about his relationship with Gore, beyond simply, of course, the pieties of eulogies and so forth. Now, you raise numbers of other interesting questions, I mean, even more interesting questions, and let me just select the issue of Gore and Jews, Gore and anti-Semitism. And has been and continues to be somewhat controversial. There is no question that that Gore had a complex relationship with the Jewish world and the Jewish scene, and part of that was his Southern and Washingtonian Southern background, and in which there was a touch of elitism, in which Jews were not completely accepted. Part of that was political, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, when Gore became quite critical of Israel and the Israeli-American alliance, which he thought of as imperialistic, in both in the Middle East and around the rest of the world. And, of course, he had a terribly hard time with the commentary people, with Podoretz and others, who immediately branded him as anti-Semitic because of his criticism of Israel. So this created a complicated interaction. Now, I never saw in my own relationship with Gore any touch of anti-Semitism. I am of Jewish background. He did not hesitate to select me as his biographer. And his lifelong partner, Howard Austin, was a Jewish by birth and had many connections, if you will, to the Jewish world that he grew up in. So, you see, these things, you know, can get quite complicated. And I do not think of Gore as being anti-Semitic, though occasionally he allowed himself in anger to, especially in regard to political matters, to say things in a way that could easily be interpreted by sensitive and understandably sensitive people as being anti-Semitic.
Thank you, Randy, very much for your call. We go to Mary in Milwaukee next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was really happy to hear your introduction in which you talked about the fact that back in the day, intellectuals were considered household names, and I do remember that growing up. In particular, I remember seeing Gore Vidal on talk shows like Dick Cavett, David Frost, and Johnny Carson, and I was wondering if your guests could please comment on Gore Vidal's conflicted relationship with Truman Capote.
Gore had a strong sense of competition with Truman Capote and with Norman Mailer. And part of the problem that with Gore's relationship with Truman Capote over the years was that they took from the very start an immediate dislike to one another. Part of it had to do, I think, with culture and sexuality. That is, Capote clearly was identifiable in certain stereotypical ways as a gay man. Gore was not. And Gore detested that kind of gay flamboyance, if you will. Among other reasons, because he deeply believed that all human beings, male and female, are in essence bisexual and could be either heterosexual or homosexual, or and he simply didn't like even those two terms, you see. All human beings are sexual beings. Culture, in essence, determines childhood and development, what kind of sexual preferences one develops over a lifetime. That, of course, was not a message that the gay community in the 1990s wanted to hear. And the dominant view in the gay community, clearly in recent decades, and it seems now to be supported in the psychological and the scientific community, is that human beings are born with such a tendency, or a tendency to be homosexual or heterosexual. I am not an expert on this subject. I know only what most people who read the newspapers and the magazines know about it. But this was a sensitive matter for Gore. That is, he did not in any way want to or countenance the possibility that there was a gap between masculinity and sex preference. Now, so he and Truman Capote started off on a bad foot right from the start, but the most important thing really is that they were literary competitors and competing for the national stage, because as you say, in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, intellectuals still mattered. And they got the opportunity to have a large and broad audience. Novels were widely read. They were considered important cultural events. They were reviewed all over. Novelists and other writers went on major television shows. That, of course, is hardly, if ever, the case these days. And Vidal was very aware in his later years and wrote about this, that the novelist and literature itself had been displaced, as intellectuals had been displaced from the center of American culture into some peripheral outer circle.
Isn't that sad?
It is indeed sad. And, you know, part of it's the rise of the electronic age with not only television, of course, but all sorts of other things that have happened since. And generations now that are more attuned to the soundbite than to serious discussion.
Yes. And what about his relationship with Johnny Carson? Could you say that Johnny Carson was influential in furthering Gore's television career, or was it somebody else, or was it a combination of
them? Yes, you're right. Johnny Carson was influential only in the sense that he gave Gore his biggest audience. The Tonight Show, of course, had millions and millions of people who watched it on a regular basis, whereas the talk shows that Gore otherwise appeared on, like the Dick Cavett Show, though they had prestige and sizable audiences in those days, still had much smaller audiences than did the Tonight Show. So Gore loved being on the Johnny Carson Show because of that wide exposure. But there wasn't a television camera that Gore Vidal didn't love. And he was a great, he performed. You know, he put on a show for all those who are interested.
Thank you, Mary, for your call. Ed in West Dallas, hello.
Hello. Well, those of us in the working class and union movement loved Vidal because he made mincemeat of William F. Buckley, Jr. in the 1968 convention. Part of it, though, is that we never really had someone from our own ilk be able to get on television. Another novelist equal to Vidal, James Farrell, never made it onto the TV screens or the radio. And I'd like to know a little bit about Vidal's relationship, I guess through marriage, with John F. Kennedy. And because he lived in Italy for so long, was he fluent in Italian?
Well, two different but also very interesting questions. Of course, Gore was related to Jackie Kennedy through the marriage of his mother to Jackie Kennedy's stepfather. It gets a little complicated.
Right.
I hope I'm remembering this correctly. I think I am.
You are.
And Gore, you know, as I said, it wasn't a television camera that Gore didn't love, but there was also hardly a celebrity that Gore, well, not that Gore wasn't interested in being associated with. This was a side of Gore that I didn't find all that attractive myself, but he lived in a world in which there was a great deal of cachet, and it was just assumed, if you were part of that world, of course, that you knew everybody, and there was a great deal of cachet in being able to talk casually about famous people, celebrities, etc. And this Gore did all the time. And, you know, it could be fascinating, it could be entertaining. He sometimes did it to excess. It could be a little boring, and even sometimes a little something to be a little critical of. But that's who he was. And so he took great pride for quite some time in his Kennedy connection. He did have a falling out with Robert Kennedy because from the start they never liked one another. A famous Bobby, of course, took a dislike to Gore. One could see why. They were such different personalities. Gore's relationship was essentially with Jackie and then through Jackie with JFK. Now, you know, these people lived at a certain kind of level of manipulativeness that most of us can't even comprehend. And so everything was both personal and impersonal. In the late 50s and through the mid-60s, Gore attempted to have a political career and ran for the Democratic nomination for Senate in California and ran for the House of Representatives from upstate New York, lost both elections. How Gore could ever have imagined realistically that someone with his voice and sense of self could ever be attractive enough to the broad American electorate so as to receive a majority vote in an election is a little beyond my comprehension. But he came from a political family. His grandfather had been a very prominent senator from the state of Missouri on his maternal side. So he had that sense of him. And he had this involvement then with the Kennedys because it was the most politically alive time for him, and they could be useful to him, and he could be useful to them. And he was useful to them for a short time in a small way.
Hmm. Our caller mentioned the 1968 Democratic Convention, and I wanted to play this. We have to hear from Gore a little bit, and then have you talk about whether or not he eviscerated Buckley in these comments. This was a debate about the Vietnam War, and they were both commentators for ABC News. This is during the Democratic National Convention.
You must realize what some of the political issues are here, that many people in the United States happen to believe that the United States policy is wrong in Vietnam, and the Viet Cong are correct in wanting to organize their country in their own way politically. This happens to be pretty much the opinion of Western Europe and many other parts of the world. If it is a novelty in Chicago, that is too bad. I assume that the point of the American democracy is you can express any point of view you want. Shut up a minute.
No, I won't. Some people were pro-Nazi, and the answer is that they were well-treated by people who ostracized them, and I'm for ostracizing people who egg on other people to shoot American Marines and American soldiers.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro- or crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Let's stop calling me a crypto Nazi. Let's stop calling names. 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 Let last war.
You were not an infantry, as a matter of fact.
I was the second lieutenant of the
Oh, my goodness, that's just an incredible exchange, isn't it?
Indeed. I mean, both great performers, a great sense of theater. You know, there they are on national television. I think it was ABC. And so it was wonderfully refreshing. Whoever heard talk like that on TV before, and we hardly hear it now.
No, we don't.
But it was also, I found, you know, in retrospect, I loved it when I first heard it. I was a young man at the time. I wish, in some ways, I'm delighted that it happened. Some ways, I wish it hadn't. It was, in retrospect, it's a little embarrassing. These two dignified and wonderfully brilliant men performing in a really uncivilized way. I agree. My own political view was then the same as Gore's, and I disagreed very much with the Buckley's ideology and his approach to conservative movement and the Vietnam War. Buckley was himself an estimable man, worthy, separate from differences one has with his views, of respect. So I feel a little sorry that both behaved in that way, though I love the performance.
Yes. And is it true that they both shared similar views about America's entry into World War II, that they had
yes.
misgivings?
Yes, they both did. And by the way, about that exchange at the 68 convention, in later years, Buckley declined to talk about it, except he said he wished he hadn't performed the way he had. He really regretted that he had engaged with Vidal at the level at which they engaged. And, of course, for most of us, Vidal got the better of it, but
right.
Simply as a performance. Yes, it is the case, I think, that... would you remind me, Kath? My mind wandered for a moment.
About their reluctance to enter World War II.
Yes, they both came from isolationist backgrounds. And Gore never quite gave that up, you know. And so there's a long history of America firstism in both Gore's leftist ideology and Buckley's rightist ideology. They converged in the sense that America should be fortress America. Gore Vidal, from the point of view eventually, that we had no right to tell other people all over the world how to behave, how to perform, and to impose our will on them, and that empire was disastrous for American democracy. Buckley, from the approach, the conservative approach, which approved of American force and power around the world, but felt it was being badly misused in ways that were damaging to America.
Thanks, Ed, for your call. We go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. This is sort of a follow-up to the business about living in an electronic age. I'm wondering what the author knows of either the amount or location or availability of any private papers left after Gore's death for future commentators. I recall a college professor saying once when they had discovered some mass of Horace Walpole correspondence that scholars were frightened that we were moving into an age when everything would be preserved, and now with all this Twitter and tweeting and emailing and stuff, I'm worried that with future authors, but even with people like Gore, who are kind of transgenerational, Gore Vidal, that maybe some of what he had to say is lost or is unavailable.
Gore is someone who had a great respect for his own words. We all have respect for our own words, but Gore's was gargantuan. And he saved every scrap of paper. I know this from experience, going through archives. Nothing was too trivial, too small, not to be put into a box and saved. And in later years, he took to writing lots of faxes, and of course, that meant he had the fax on the other end. He had the original of the fax. And of course, most of his telephone calls were not recorded, and he could talk at great length on the telephone. So those are lost. He, of course, gave so many had so many television appearances, radio interviews for print reporters, for biographers, and so on. And so those are taped and saved. There's a huge Gore Vidal archive. It originally was, and that's where I delved into it, in your state, at the Wisconsin State Historical Society.
Really? Oh.
Yes, yes. Hundreds of cubic feet of shelves of boxes of Gore Vidal archival material. So for years and years, at least once or twice a year, he and Howard would ship off from Italy, from Ravello, boxes of this material to Wisconsin.
Why to Wisconsin?
Because Gore first became a minor prominent figure as a writer of television scripts and movie scripts in the 1950s and early 1960s. The Wisconsin State Historical Society Library, a great library, specialized at that time and still does in television radio and theater and movie history. It was a magnificent collection. So Gore found out about this, and he was looking for a library to donate his material to for the benefit of what was then a tax deduction. That kind of tax deduction is no longer available, since he wanted to reduce the taxes that he was paying on his income that he was getting from Hollywood and other places. Over the years, Gore became increasingly disaffiliated from the Wisconsin State Historical Society Library because she thought they weren't quite doing enough for his collection. They weren't cataloging it fast enough, et cetera, et cetera. I believe he was mistaken. They were wonderful people. I'm sure they still are. They were wonderful to me when I visited and spent months and months there going through the archives. Gore eventually arranged to have all his material withdrawn from the Wisconsin State Historical Society. This is as late as the 1990s, and sent to Harvard University Library, which welcomed it, and where it now is in the Houghton Collection. And this is an aspect of Gore that one has to understand. He's immensely ambitious, narcissistic, and egomaniacal, and ruthless. Ruthless when it came to himself and his reputation and his future and so forth. I thought it was a shoddy thing to do, frankly, and I sort of mumbled that to him, but it really wasn't my place to be critical of him. I was there to listen to him and write a biography.
So he alienated many people, including you, it sounds like.
Yes, he did. He did. But he and I, when we entered into our relationship, agreed. And I asked him to put it in writing, because I also already, you know, knew something about him, that he would attempt to exercise no control over the biography that I would write. He would give me complete access, and he would not see the book until it was published. I had an inkling, and I learned along the way that Gore likes to control. Gore liked to control everything that was written about him if he possibly could. And that when I edited an interchange of letters, and by the way, it was a magnificent letter writer between Gore Vidal and Louis Auchincloss, which the New Yorker published, when it went to Gore for his oversight, he wanted to rewrite letters written 20 and 30
years. Oh, my goodness.
So he wanted to rewrite them.
Oh, no.
So when it came to history, particularly his own, he believed in recreation or fiction or changing it or what have you. At any rate, so I had him put in writing this agreement between us. And then as the book was going to press, I got a call from him as if the letter never existed, as if our letter of agreement never existed. Fred, now it's time for me to see the book before it goes into print. And I said, no, Gore, it is not. Let me tell you about our letter of agreement. What letter of agreement? He said in his deep and resonant voice. And I had it handy, naturally, hoping this call wouldn't come, but aware that it might. And I read him the letter, and he was nonplussed, not because of the existence of the letter, but because he could not persuade me or my publisher, Doubleday, to agree to allow him to vet the manuscript in advance of publication. And he got obstreperous and consulted a prominent New York City attorney, and that attorney and other people eventually calmed him down about it and told him, in effect, he wasn't going to get any place. He had no case. So that led to a degree of alienation between us. I was a little disappointed, but not very much, because then, you know, this was another chapter, so to speak, in the biography.
Right. Fred Kaplan, our guest this hour. He is the author of Gore Vidal, a biography. He's written many other biographies as well, on Lincoln, on Charles Dickens. He's writing one now on John Quincy Adams. He had great access to conversations with Gore Vidal and has written about him. We are talking about him, of course, because he died last month. We wanted to do the show earlier, but our program that had been scheduled with Fred was preempted due to serious news here in Wisconsin. So we're talking about him today. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation, or you could also leave a message for us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gore Vidal, our focus this hour with his biographer, Fred Kaplan. The book is Gore Vidal, A Biography. Our number again is 800-486-8655. In a piece that you have written about Gore Vidal, you've said actually a couple times in your own essay that in your view, he should have stuck to literature, he should have not alienated so many people, and he should have given higher value to truth than wit. Where did he not give higher value to truth, and how would his work have been substantially different if he had valued truth?
You quote my words back to me, and I want to revise them now. Can I rewrite them?
We don't have a contract. Sure you can.
Gore loved wit and the play of the mind, and he loved humor and jokes, and he had a sharp satiric tongue, and he exaggerated and he distorted. What did he exaggerate and distort? He exaggerated and distorted people's characters. He could be very mean and totally unfair to the actual record of what a person had said or done, both in his personal life and in the political world. And he wouldn't hesitate to sacrifice historical accuracy or literal accuracy for either a witticism or the point he wanted to make. Extended comments and essays that he wrote in later life is a good though extreme example, and that has to do with the Oklahoma bomber, bombing, which the man's name I believe is Timothy McVie. Have I got it right?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And so Gore spoke on TV and on radio and wrote an essay in which he, in effect, was sympathetic to or expressed understanding for the political ideology that McVie was expressing, and distorted the facts of what had occurred so that it almost seemed as if nobody had been murdered in Oklahoma City. That was not on Gore's mind, and he didn't care to be sympathetic in that regard. He had a point to make about American society and American culture. And so there was a sort of, you know, universal insensitivity in that kind of comment that offended so many people. And Gore was not good at taking the pulse of other people and of other situations. He really specialized in his own pulse. And of course, a lot of great writers and political leaders are that way. Their own pulse is more important than anybody else's. And maybe in a sense, but in a very smaller sphere, we also take, every one of us is the same. But Gore was that writ large.
Mm-hmm. You're working on a book now, or is it completed on John Quincy Adams?
I'm in the latter stages of a 5-year project.
Oh my!
There's so much archival research, and the Massachusetts Historical Society has this immense John Quincy Adams collection, this immense Adams family collection. There's John Adams and Abigail Adams and John Quincy and Charles. This is immensely rich and full archive by a family of writers. And so John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States, like Lincoln, the 16th president, had a genius for language. Most of us don't know much about it because of how he is viewed in the historical retrospect as a president. But he is a wonderful writer, a poet, a translator from classical languages and from French, a wonderful essayist, a man of great intellectual capability, probably our most learned president, and I am attempting to write a life that will remind people of what a visionary man and what a brilliantly talented man he was.
Hmm. You must love your work. I would love doing what you're
doing. I'm very fortunate, Kathleen. I'm a blessed human being, and I do love my work. Mm-hmm. And I've had the opportunity to practice it.
Well, please let us know when the book is over. I'm anxious to read it, and I thank you so much for this very interesting hour. Thank you.
My pleasure, Kathleen. My pleasure indeed.
Fred Kaplan, the book is Gore Vidal, a biography. He's also written, and they're worth reading, I'm sure, as well, Lincoln, the biography of a writer. He has written biographies of Charles Dickens and many others, and we thank him for spending time with us talking about Gore Vidal. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program, and thanks for your calls. We have news coming up in just one moment, and we will return with another hour of conversation, and it should be a rip-roaring good conversation with the author of The Party Is Over. So please stay with us as we talk about what's happened to the Republicans, what's happened to the Democrats, and what's happened to the middle class.